his hands and bringing it down on Logovit's skull with a brittle, pulpy crunch.
Goodbye, Logovic.
Logovic fell, but before he could even hit the floor, Nail had seized him by the throat, swinging him back upward, and went to take a great, ravenous bite of the man's face. Smite turned away. He didn't feel bold anymore. Now he felt like he was going to be sick. A foot connected with his chest, driving the air out of him, embedding the nausea more deeply in his guts. He was going to die here along with all the rest of them. He writhed, squirming, and then he saw it. The open panel from which the Bone Kings had emerged. It was still open. Chaos still gripped the ready room, which seemed absurdly cramped for the outburst of activity within it. But the one-sided assault was already losing momentum. On both sides, Nailhead Strabo and their minions were merely eviscerating the final remaining guards, years of compressed rage exploding out of them in seconds as they shredded the men and left their bodies impaled against the walls. Amid it all, Warden Blur looked on serenely. After another moment, she turned and walked out, with her droid behind her, the hatch sealing shut. Smite didn't have much time. Still on his hands and knees, he scampered forward as fast as he could between the bodies and under the broken remains of the table. Ducking his head low, he leapt through the open passageway into darkness.
Antidote.
From 20 meters back, Maul watched Zero emerge through the line in the mess hall. He waited while the Twi'lek sat down, picked up his fork, and began, thoughtfully and deliberately, to eat. 3 bites. 4. 5. Maul sat down across from him.
Hello, Zero.
The Twi'lek's fork fell from his hand with a clatter. His jaw fell open to reveal the half-chewed mouthful of food he'd been in the process of swallowing. It wasn't a pretty sight.
Jagannath, he whispered. You're supposed to be...
dead?
Maul glared at him.
I can understand your confusion. When you left me on the factory floor, I was on the verge of being pulled to pieces. Yet here I am.
The Twi'lek managed to swallow, but he still couldn't speak. His eyes darted right and left, the muscles of his throat twitching visibly beneath his skin, as if he were struggling fruitlessly to digest the physical evidence of Maul's presence here.
You don't understand, he said. You can't be here. He thinks you're dead.
Zero started to stand up, and Maul's hand moved faster than the eye could see, grabbing Zero's fork and slamming it down so that it impaled the Twi'lek's sleeve, pinning his arm to the table. At the next table, 3 big inmates rose to their feet and started toward Maul. Without taking his gaze from the Twi'lek, Maul spoke, just loud enough for Zero to hear.
Tell them to sit back down.
Zero looked up at his bodyguards.
It's all right, he said in a thin voice. Go sit down.
The inmates returned haltingly to their meals.
It's an interesting thing,
Maul said softly.
Whom we serve and why. At first you told me that Iram Radik doesn't exist. The next thing I know, you're working for him.
You have no idea.
I took the old man with me when I walked out of the factory floor.
Maul continued.
He's not doing well. That blood infection's going to kill him. But he did tell me something interesting before he became completely delirious. He told me that you answered to a different name.
Zero's face showed no expression. Which is?
That's what you're going to tell me.
Jagannath, please. The Twi'lek's voice was low and urgent. You must listen to me. I've been in this place from the beginning. There's a reason I've survived this long.
Right before I killed Rook,
Maul said,
I asked him if there was someone else. Someone above him who worked directly with Radik. He drew something with his finger. At the time, I thought it was just a circle. But it wasn't.
He leaned in closer until his face was almost touching the Twi'lek's.
It was a zero.
Rook? The Twi'lek shook his head. Rook was just...
a decoy.
Maul said, and nodded, his voice holding no inflection whatsoever.
I see that now. Handing him over was your way of taking my attention from where it should have been the whole time.
He glanced at Zero's tray, where the Twi'lek's special meal sat half-eaten.
You know, I noticed that you always enjoy a better quality of food than the other inmates. One of the benefits of being the one who can smuggle things into the prison, I assume. Unfortunately, it also makes you far more vulnerable.
To what?
I slipped a crushed gram of white metaxas root into the vat just before you came through the line today.
Maul said, in that same dispassionate voice.
Coyle tried to give it to me earlier. Fortunately, he still had it when I came back and asked for it again. I'm told that it's odorless and flavorless, but fast-acting.
He glanced down at the half-finished meal.
And you've already eaten enough to kill you.
Zero stared down at the tray in dawning horror, and then shoved it away from him, as if mere physical proximity might be enough to stop what had already begun. Why?
There is an antidote,
Maul said, opening his hand to show Zero a small clear vial of gray powder.
Something I lifted from medbay. If I give it to you in the next 30 seconds, you'll survive.
I already told you.
I've seen Radik's face,
Maul said.
Now I need to make arrangements with him. I'm willing to pay 300,000 credits for a prescribed nuclear device. I have the money here. I will make contact with the buyers personally and arrange for their arrival to take possession of the weapon.
He... Zero's hands had begun trembling. He gazed at them in terrified wonder, then back up at Maul. He'll never agree to the deal.
Why not?
He knows the Bandogora. They tried to kill him once already. They are sworn enemies. He's made a blood oath never to do business with them.
Then you'll have to change his mind, won't you?
You... fool! Zero's entire body had begun to shake. When he spoke again, his voice was trembling, the words spilling from his lips in halting bursts. You have no idea what you've done! His head fell to the table with a crash. With a grimace of irritation, Maul hoisted Zero's face out of his food, inspected his eyes, and let his head drop again. He left him like that, and walked out of the mess hall.
Crawl.
Smite ran. By the time the screaming in the ready room finally trailed away to silence, he was on his feet, barreling full tilt down the maintenance shaft, sprinting headlong through the near darkness. He didn't know where he was going or what he would do when he got there,
But right now, that wasn't as important as putting as much distance as possible between himself and the gang members who had pursued him. His skull was pounding, his lungs blazed. Rounding a corner, unable to go another step without resting, he sagged against the cold wall and sucked in a deep, ragged breath. The glitter stim had worn off completely now, and he felt wrung out and edgy, shaking so hard that he could scarcely stand up, his knees threatening to betray him at any second. Look at the facts. Fact number one. He was an unarmed guard trapped inside a prison full of homicidal monsters, any of whom would relish the opportunity to kill him. Fact number two. He couldn't go back to Jabba for help, even if there was some way of contacting him. Conclusion? He was a walking dead man. Smite fought the almost irresistible urge to weep, to scream, to collapse. None of those things would help him now. A tiny voice inside him whispered that if maybe he could sneak back to his quarters and score a little bit more of the stim that he kept tucked away among his personal items, it might help clarify things. But even that seemed hopeless. Coming down from the spice's euphoria only made him more aware of how much he'd depended on it up till now. He didn't know where he was or where he was going. He felt his gorge rising with disgust. Self-pity wrapped itself around him like a damp, familiar cloak. Having failed in his mission for Jabba, he'd validated everything about himself that he'd secretly suspected to be true. Cowardice, inadequacy, incompetence. What then was the point of going forward? Then, in the tunnel ahead of him, something moved. Smite listened. There was a muscular enormity to it. A great slithering massiveness like nothing he'd run across inside these walls. He could actually hear the sticky, clicking snap of its mouth parts. The wolfworm. He'd heard the stories of the Syrox. They all had. A thing that lived inside the pipes and ducts of the prison, that fed and grew sleek and fat on the blood of the matches. Some of the other guards even swore they'd seen it, although there was never any hard evidence of its existence. That was when he heard something else. Not out loud. In his mind. Voices.
Help, help,
the words.
Murder, kill you, strangle you all.
Emanating through his brain.
Out, innocent, out, innocence,
Smite inclined his head more closely toward the wall. Captivated in spite of himself. He wasn't imagining it. The voices emanating through his brain pan were a tangle of horrors. A braided skein of a thousand different tongues, human and non-human, all shrieking and begging and snarling and roaring for mercy, deliverance, revenge. Smite was not a particularly intelligent man by nature, but he knew enough to trust his perception, even when it flew in the face of what he thought to be true. And his perception on this matter was crystal clear. The Syrox was not only real, it was sentient. Its mind was a threnody of violence and pain, stitched together from every inmate whose body the thing had devoured during its time squirming through the guts of the prison. Their collective minds, though dead, were somehow still living inside it. Glancing up, he caught just a glimpse of something so thunderously huge and fat that it filled the entire passageway, gleaming and pale and blind-eyed, surging toward him with its mouth parts peeling open like the petals of some hideous albino flower. Smite glimpsed pink and a dozen rings of teeth. The smell that came pouring out from inside it was wretched beyond description, the stink of a mass grave. His heart sprang up to the pit of his throat and clung there, cowering. He turned and fled. Fear made him weightless, boiling him down to his most essential reflexes.
The overall effect made the stim seem weak by comparison. Strength that he'd never imagined exploded through his legs, pumping him in the opposite direction, adrenaline pounding hard through every synapse. He could hear the thing squeezing through the corridor behind him, surging forward faster now, closing the distance with every passing second. He kept his head down and doubled his pace, navigating the twists and turns purely by instinct, the gray walls flying by in a blur. Off in the distance, the thunderous approach of the thing disappeared beneath the steady pounding of his heart, its rhythms optimized for bare-bone survival. He ran harder. He could run forever if he had to. Swinging around the corner, he slammed headlong into something solid, but not as hard as a wall. It knocked him flat, and he looked up to see Vast Nailhead squinting down at him. The inmate, like the Bone Kings gathered behind him, was drenched from head to foot in blood.
Well, well.
Nailhead stood there with Strabo alongside him, the Bone Kings a massive clustering closer.
I guess there's no end to what you'll run into down here. Is there?
Smite didn't move. Couldn't breathe.
What's the matter, maggot?
Nailhead wiped his mouth with his wrist, smearing the scarlet streak of gore sideways across his beard.
No blaster you can point at me? No drop box you can punch my numbers into?
He grabbed Smite and yanked him to his feet.
What's wrong, bro? You got nothing you want to say to me?
Well,
Smite managed, in a voice that didn't sound remotely like his own. He could hear it coming again, the noise getting louder as it moved up the passageway.
There is one thing.
Yeah? What's that?
He pointed up the corridor.
You better watch out!
Nailhead tilted back his head. Behind him, Strabo was also staring. As their expressions changed, Smite himself became aware of something. The presence returning. Huge and warm and terribly eager. And then the screaming started.
Nobody's hero.
Maul elbowed his way deeper into the crowd outside the mess hall. He'd left Zero in the mess hall, slumped over in his food, having gained nothing from their last exchange. As he'd stood to go, the three inmates who'd approached them earlier had grabbed the Twi'lek and carried him off, no doubt rushing him to medbay. Maul doubted they would make it in time, but he supposed it was possible, if they hurried. Right now, he had more pressing business to take care of. He found the boy in the cell, sitting next to his father's body. The old man lay motionless on the bunk, breathing shallowly. His skin was mottled with a sallow, blotchy cast.
Jagannath,
Egan asked.
What?
Pick him up, Maul said. We need to move.
Where?
Follow me.
Gently, Egan leaned down and gathered his father's body in his arms. The morgue was as silent as Maul remembered it. They stepped through the hatchway single file, the boy shifting his father's weight to his shoulder in order to get through the entrance.
What are we doing here?
Egan asked uneasily. Maul didn't look back.
Lay him down there,
he said, nodding to indicate one of the empty tables extending from the wall.
You still haven't told me what...
Has he said anything else about the Bandogora?
Maul asked.
Anything at all?
No. I told you, he can't talk. The infection, it...
The boy swallowed, unable to complete the thought.
He needs medicine.
Maul said nothing, reaching down beneath the lowermost console to retrieve the hollow transmitter from where he'd stashed it, pressing in the code to activate its primary drives. Then he turned to face Artigan Truax.
Old man.
The eyelids lifted slightly, regarding him dully. Cracked lips moved but made no sound.
I need you to enter the hailing frequency for the Bandogora.
Mole said. Artigan Truax managed to shake his head.
Don't remember, anything.
You're going to have to remember,
Mole said.
Or I'm going to kill your son.
Egan turned to stare at him. The old man tried to sit up.
The frequency,
Mole said.
Put it in.
After what seemed like forever, Artigan Truax began to type. His fingers clicked shakily across the key controls, stabbing in coordinates in uneven bursts. Finishing, he sagged backward into silence.
Is that it?
The old man said nothing. Maul was still watching him when he became aware of the boy's eyes, fixed on the passageway outside.
Do you hear that?
He asked.
It's the clarion call.
Maul listened. Egan was right.
Leave me, he said. Now.
The boy glanced at his father.
Where should I?
It doesn't matter. Take him away. Back to your cell,
Maul said.
Just go.
When Egan had lifted his father in his arms and carried him off, Maul switched out the hailing frequency for the holotransmitter and activated the device again. He knelt before it, his head lowered, waiting. Within seconds, Darth Sidious appeared in front of him. This time, he didn't bother with the formalities.
You have news? I do, my master,
Maul said.
What is it? Iram Radik,
Maul said.
I found him.
Moments later, Maul was back down on the factory floor, making his way through the bone statues, searching the shadows for the one who could help him advance to the next stage of his search. His master's response to the news of Iram Radik's identity had not been what he'd hoped. Sidious had listened impatiently while Maul told him about the weak way, and how he'd narrowly escaped being pulled to pieces without betraying his abilities as a force user. In the end, his master had simply nodded, as if all of this should have happened far more expediently than it had, and demanded that Maul contact him when the deal was finished. He'd said nothing about the Bandogora, or the difficulty of brokering an arrangement between the cult and Radik. That detail had been left for Maul to arrange, hence his return to the factory floor, where he'd nearly died. He stepped forward, listening carefully until he recognized the sound of the Chadra fans humming in the darkness.
Ah, Jagannath!
Coil turned, already smiling up at Maul expectantly.
You have come for what is yours, yes?
Is it ready?
Just finished.
Still humming, the other inmate turned and walked away, leading him around a pile of loosely assembled bones, then digging through debris, both mechanical and organic, until he found a flat metal case, holding it up for Maul's inspection.
300,000 credits.
A glimmer of pride lit the Chadra fan's eye.
Authentic enough to fool the most discriminating inspection. Do you approve?
Maul looked down at the stacks and rows of bundled currency, then picked one up from the top and held it to the light. The craftsmanship, while thorough, probably wouldn't hold up to close scrutiny, but it would open the doors that he needed to go through to arrange the final details with Radik. At this point, it would have to suffice. Amid the press of reeking bodies that filled the corridor, Maul pushed his way along with the metal case at his side. A bulky Bone King bumped shoulders with him, too close to be accidental. Without turning or even breaking stride, he drove his fist into the king's solar plexus, leaving him doubled over on the floor, gasping for air. He stopped in his tracks. His gaze had fallen on an inmate standing absolutely motionless amid the flow of bodies around him. For a moment, the entire world went still. All sound dropped away. It was him. The one he'd seen standing side by side with Zero on the factory floor. Radik. The Weequay was gazing back at him through the crowds of inmates, the clawbird perched on his shoulder. Maul watched as he pulled a scrap of greasy-looking bantha suet from the pocket of his uniform and held it up unhurriedly for the bird to snatch from his fingers. In the blink of an eye, the food disappeared, and the Weequay dug out another chunk. The bird gobbled it even faster than before, its head bobbing in an eager attempt to get the morsel down its throat. With the metal case that Coyle had given him still at his hip, Maul shoved his way through the crowd, knocking over other inmates. But when he got to where the Weequay had been standing, the other was gone. Maul turned and looked in every direction. The corridors were clearing now as the last stragglers returned to their cells for matching. The clarion blared on.
You're so close now. You can't stop.
Maul turned and almost ran head first into the guard standing there.
You heard the clarion.
The guard glared at him.
Why aren't you in your cell?
I'm on my way now,
Maul said.
Hold it, maggot.
The guard glared at the metal case in Maul's hand.
What's that?
I salvaged it from the pile in Nightside.
What's inside?
Nothing.
Nothing.
The guard yanked the case from Maul's hands and popped it open, lifting the lid and tipping it upside down. A loose pile of bones fell out, clattering to the floor. Kicking them aside, the guard tossed the case and glared at Maul.
Get to your cell now.
The main monkey business.
Good things were happening. Siddiqui sat where the boots propped up on her desk, sipping coffee and smiling. She and 3D had finished watching the slaughter of the guards from the comfort of her office, where she wouldn't have to worry about getting blood on her suit. As pure spectacle, it didn't disappoint. Too bad she hadn't had time to auction the Holovid broadcast rights. Or even better, to take bets on the outcome. Not that anyone in their right mind would have bet on a group of unarmed prison guards against Strabo and Nailhead and their followers. She had no doubt there would be repercussions to what she'd done. One didn't trifle with Jabba the Hutt without getting some pushback in one form or another, but at the moment, she was feeling relatively... what? Invulnerable, she said aloud. And the droid perked up.
Excuse me?
Bulletproof. That's where we are right now. Siddiqui took another sip of coffee. It's a good position to be in, 3D.
Yes, Warden. However, I can't help but wonder...
Shush. Siddiqui held up her hand. You're spoiling the moment. How long till the next fight?
It's starting any minute now. The algorithm.
She checked the screens in front of her, took her feet off her desk, and stared downward at the display. Wait a second, she said, looking up at the droid. Where's Takari?
I don't know.
This isn't right. There's got to be some mistake. She watched as the algorithm selected its two combatants. Find my brother. Find him now.
I'm sure I don't know where he is,
Siddiqui cursed. Where's the override? 3D made a quick chirping sound, and its breastplate dialed open to extrude a slender adapter, plugging it into the console next to Siddiqui's desk.
Accessing algorithm override.
it said, and there was a long pause.
I can't override the system. I'm afraid the combatants have already been locked in.
My brother can fix it,
Siddiqui said.
I'm afraid that's simply not possible.
Why?
Because he's the one who locked them in.
Siddiqui frowned at the display.
Dakari's in the system somewhere.
He's accessed it remotely somehow.
It doesn't make sense. Why would he do that?
The droid swiveled its head to regard her, its photoreceptors pulsating busily.
Respectfully, Warden, when was the last time you saw Master Dakari?
Siddiqui didn't answer. She was still looking at the screens.
Dakari? What are you doing?
Bleed the Freak.
Maul made it back just seconds before the reconfiguration began. He'd just stepped through the hatchway when it sealed shut behind him, the floor and walls already starting to shift. As the now familiar clamor of gears and clockwork filled the air, he turned his gaze upward to where he knew the Warden and the rest of the galactic gambling community would be watching. His involvement in the next bout seemed to be a foregone conclusion.
What would it be this time? Fire? Ice? The Sarlacc from the Great Pit of Carcoon?
The cell reeled and swung as the architecture of the prison fell into its newest alignment. Maul held fast to the hand grips of the bench, riding it out. At this point, it really didn't matter what they pitted him against. Now that he'd seen Radik face to face, the cell came to a halt. Maul cocked his head, listening for whatever opponent the algorithm had selected for him. Whatever it was, he would kill it as quickly as possible and get on with his business at hand. The wall of the cell came open. Maul looked into it, muscles tensing for the attack, and felt all his resolve go swirling away in a sudden rush of bewilderment. The Weequay stepped out to face him. For a moment he couldn't speak. The Weequay was walking toward him with the clawbird resting on his shoulder. Maul stared, his senses heightened by the intensity of his shock, as the bird lifted one of its talons, shifting its position to reveal the knots of quipus tied around its feet.
"You are supposed to die already, Jagannath," the Weequay said. "Torn to pieces on the factory floor. I should have finished you myself."
He was still coming. Maul was struck again by the ineluctable suspicion that everything that had happened to him since the moment of his arrival here, from the ongoing matches to the riddles to the machines that had nearly ripped him to pieces, had all been part of some larger trial or examination overseen by Sidious. And that perhaps now he had arrived at the greatest test of all.
"Wait," Maul said. "I won't kill you."
"You're right about that."
Maul reached up and yanked open his collar to reveal the bundles of credits that he'd stuffed inside his uniform before leaving Nightside. He held them up.
300,000 credits. They're yours.
The Weequay didn't answer. Instead, he raised his arm, and the bird took flight. Arrowing across the cell like a shadow cut loose from the object that cast it, streaking straight for Maul's face, talons extended. Ducking, Maul swung one fist to knock it aside, but the bird dove down under his arm at the last second and came up screaming, claws fastened to his face, pecking furiously at his eyes. Maul grabbed the bird blindly, ripped it from where it had fastened itself to his face, and tried to fling it to the floor where he could stomp it to death. But it squirmed free and took flight, still cawing and shrieking across the cell in a trail of feathers. He raised his head and wiped his eyes.
His vision was a curtain of blood, beyond which the Weequay rose, the vaguest of shapes, though nearer than ever.
I know exactly what you are, Radik's voice said, very close. And I know who sent you here.
He was raising something over his head. Some kind of melee weapon, some dagger or pike whose specifics Maul couldn't immediately discern, already intent on delivering the death blow.
Now I will give you what you deserve.
A supernova of pain exploded through Maul's right flank, and his right arm went numb, even as he lifted it in an attempt at self-defense. But the paralysis went far deeper than that. For the first time since he'd arrived at Coghive 7, Maul had no idea how to proceed. Killing Radik now would mean the end of his mission. Total failure in the eyes of his master and the Sith. Yet anything less would cost him his life.
You serve the Bandor Gora,
the Weequay's voice was saying, from somewhere behind the Scarlet Veil.
No, Maul said. That's not...
From behind him, the pounding of wings. Maul reacted on instinct, swinging his left arm back to pluck the clawbird out of the air. His right arm remained useless. Whatever the Weequay had done to him with the melee weapon seemed to have severed his control of it, at least temporarily. Gripping one of the bird's wings with his left hand, Maul bit down on the other wing and clamped it between his teeth, spreading them apart to their fullest span.
Keep it disoriented. Work it into a frenzy until it cannot tell friend from enemy. It's the only way.
The bird fought him with everything it had, twisting and writhing, pecking frantically, screaming in his grasp. Its talons raked his face, carving deep furrows across his cheekbones. But Maul did not let it go. He swung it through the air, slashing it across the Weequay's face in a definitive stroke, simultaneously breaking its back while raking the thing's claws over the Weequay's eyes. The bird fell to the floor, a broken thing, its wings protruding at awkward, irrational angles. Maul wiped the blood from his face. At last, his vision had begun to clear. Stepping back, he raised his left hand in one final attempt to communicate with the Weequay.
Hear me, he said. I'm not here representing the Bandor Gora. I need to buy a weapon from you. I need...
Radik attacked him again. A quick, brutal series of blows to neck and face. They came almost too fast to register. A fierce storm of blows. And Maul was aware of the floor shifting beneath him, dropping him to his knees. When the Weequay's pike smashed into his skull again, Maul realized that right here and now, in the midst of his crisis, Radik was going to beat him to death. It was going to end here.
Master!
The uncertainty of it loomed over him, clouding his thoughts.
What should I do? How can I...
Another blow, the most vicious one yet, split the thought in half, and Maul dropped to his stomach. He knew that failure would cost him everything, that he would never be able to return to Sidious and the grand plan. And yet, Maul's thoughts cycled back to his early childhood. Further back than he'd ever dared reflect. To his earliest training. The endless, hostile torture that he'd endured on Maegito. As painful as it had been, there was knowledge there. A realization that in the end, the galaxy was a cold and uncaring place that would never protect him. And if he was going to survive, it would only be because he would never give up.
Never give up. Not then. Not now. Never!
Something broke open inside him. A vein of pure instinct that ran even deeper than his commitment to the mission. On his feet at once, he grabbed the Weequay by his seclusion braids, jerked the other's head back, and thrust his own head forward, driving the horns of his skull against the inmate's throat. Radik's windpipe burst open, splintering beneath the attack. His body fell limp, and Maul released the braids, letting him drop to the floor.
Maul stepped back from the corpse. He stood there for what felt like a long time. It was over.
Master, I had no choice.
But there was only silence.
"43. Kaldani Spires.
I suppose this means you may congratulate your apprentice," Darth Plagueis observed. "On a job well done."
He had just turned his attention from the holovid screen to gaze out the window of his penthouse at the top of Kaldani Spires, down on the unsuspecting crowds thronging Monument Square far below. On the opposite side of the room, Sidious stood, simmering with his fists clenched, the muscles of his jaw tight with anger. He could not discern Plagueis' expression reflected in the glass, nor could he guess his master's thoughts from his tone of voice. All around him, Plagueis' lavishly appointed penthouse had fallen absolutely silent, a reverential stillness prevailing over the richly brocaded carpeting, resonating from the elaborate furnishings, tapestries, and artifacts that adorned the rooms and corridors. Sidious could hear the pounding of his own outraged pulse. They had just finished the Hollow of Maul's most recent bout, the first one that they'd watched together, although Sidious had been monitoring each of his apprentice's fights carefully from the time Maul had first arrived on Coggive 7. Today, without warning or precedent, Plagueis had summoned him here so that they could watch the fight together. It was as if he'd known what would happen.
His mission was to assassinate Radik without relying on the Force,
Plagueis mused as he turned back to face Sidious.
Was it not?
As was so often the case, the elongated grayish-blue face behind the transpirator mask was neither smiling nor frowning. Instead, the mask wore the distant, abstracted expression of a profoundly advanced intellect lost deep in his own counsel.
Which means that he's finished there, yes?
Ready to be extracted. Sidious managed a single nod. Deep within him, the rage grew more intense, and he still did not trust his own voice.
And yet,
Plagueis said, regarding him thoughtfully,
you seem less than pleased.
With the deliberate effort of a man releasing a clenched fist, Sidious made a conscious effort at composure.
He is testing me, examining my motives.
And again the question cycled back through his head.
How much does he know?
Of course I'm pleased,
Sidious said, careful to maintain unbroken eye contact with Plagueis as he spoke each word. There could be no indication of treachery here, no hint of the true purpose behind the mission.
Maul has done exactly as I requested.
Not that I'm questioning you, of course,
Plagueis said.
As I've said before, your business with the Zabrak, especially when it comes to this sort of thing, is exactly that. Your business.
He paused just long enough for Sidious to wonder if all of this was, in fact, just a passing remark, the equivalent of an idle thought that passed through a consciousness as heightened as Plagueis's.
I do wonder, however, about what might happen if Maul revealed his true identity as a Sith Lord while still imprisoned in this place. The implications for our plan might prove substantial.
Impossible,
Sidious said.
Maul's loyalty to us is above reproach. He would gladly lay down his life before compromising the secrecy of his mission.
Of course.
Plagueis shook his head.
I just wish to remind you that there are still aspects of this operation that may not be completely under your control. or mine.
For a moment his expression was sympathetic, indulgent in a way that, as a younger man, Sidious had once enjoyed, but now, if he was honest, found placatory, almost patronizing.
It is a painful yet necessary reminder, Darth Sidious. Beings such as ourselves, ones who enjoy the promise of nearly unlimited power, live with the paradoxical risk of forgetting that there are some elements of the galaxy that we cannot control.
Are you suggesting that the mission was a miscalculation from the beginning?
Such speculation is meaningless now.
Plagueis waited again, and Sidious sensed him closing in on his final point.
No, I suppose my true purpose, looking back on what has already happened, is to question why you felt it necessary to go to such elaborate lengths, taking inordinate chances that might potentially leave our plans vulnerable in order to find this arms dealer.
Sidious said nothing.
Unless there is something else that you had intended him for.
Plagueis finished.
As I said,
Sidious began,
the assassination of Iran Radik was necessary in order to further our ultimate goals with the grand plan.
He paused, deliberately leaving the explanation unfinished, long enough to observe whether Damask might be interested in hearing more of the cover story, which had been carefully fabricated to hold up to the most intense scrutiny if necessary. At no point in the operation could the moon be allowed to speculate that Sidious had truly sent Maul to Coghype 7 in order to purchase the nuclear device that the Bando Gora would ultimately use against Plagueis. Such a possibility, even now, was inconceivable. But Plagueis had already waved aside the explanation. And then, as quickly as it had appeared, the casual tone was gone. Gazing back at the holoscreen where they had watched the contest, his mood darkened.
He is a prideful one, the Zabrak. Is he not? As excellent as he is in combat, it must be incredibly difficult for him to show restraint in not using the Force.
He has had experience in such restraint,
Sidious reminded him, although he knew where the discussion was leading now and saw little purpose in defending Maul at this point.
I do not doubt it. It would be a great shame, however, if instead of merely killing the arms dealer, Maul inadvertently revealed more about his identity and the identity of those who sent him.
Plagueis was staring at him directly now.
In fact, I would venture to say that such an unfortunate turn of events would prove to be extremely humbling for its original architects.
Humbling.
The word plunged to the pit of Sidious's stomach and lay there like a rock.
I will take measures to personally ensure that such a thing never happens,
he said stiffly. Plagueis didn't say anything for a long time. When he spoke again, the voice in which he answered was low but firm.
Contact the Zabrak, he said. Inform him that he is to destroy Coghype 7 immediately, eradicating all evidence of our plans there.
He paused.
If you wish, you may allow him to think that he will have the opportunity to escape.
Sidious drew in a breath and held it. The muscles of his diaphragm felt uncannily unsprung. Over the past few minutes, the tension that had gathered within the penthouse had left him feeling suffocated, as if the oxygen content within these walls had been slowly but steadily drained.
Is there anything else, then?
Nothing pressing, Plagueis said. I do enjoy our conversations, Darth Sidious. There is no one else with whom I know I can be completely and totally candid. Let us not wait so long until the next meeting.
Certainly not.
Sidious nodded, and, making his goodbyes, found his way out, hearing the hatch seal and lock itself behind him.
Humbling.
The word was still there, twisting in his guts like poison. By the time he reached the turbo lifts leading down through the tower to the main lobby, he was breathing normally again, and the shaking within his chest was almost completely gone.
Shop.
Smite crawled out of the conduit and fell on the floor. He didn't remember how he'd gotten there, how long he'd been fumbling along in the dark, trying to find his way through a steadily narrowing capillary bed of ventilation shafts and pipelines that fed the prison its continuous ration of power and water and heat. His brain had long ago stopped recording outside stimuli. All his more sophisticated sensory and analytical skills had reduced themselves down to a nearly primordial state. He'd seen too much. It had started with the worm. Watching the enormous white thing in the tunnel eat the Bone Kings had been bad enough. If Smite lived to be 100, he knew he'd never forget the way that Strabo and Nailhead and the others had disappeared, sucked upward from the floor of the tunnel directly into the hideous Y-shaped mouthparts as they wrapped themselves around the inmates. But it was the sound that would stay with him most. The separating, slurping noise that the thing had made, not quite loud enough to cover the high, keening peals of their screams. And the wet slap and clomping sounds of the jaws as they snapped shut. It made him sick to think about it. The thing had devoured them wholesale, leaving Smite sprawled low on the floor of the shaft where he'd fallen, just enough time to scramble backward while the white worm finished consuming its prey. He was afraid that if he ran, it would sense him. If he made too much noise, it would hear. And so he'd crawled, silently, agonizingly, slowly, he'd crawled. The rattling tattoo of his heart, the pounding in his skull, had made it impossible to say whether the thing was still pursuing him or whether it had stayed where it was to digest the feast. And at this point, Smite had discovered that he didn't much care. If it got him, then it got him. If it didn't, he'd spend the rest of his life having nightmares that it had. Neither prospect was particularly tempting. Now, having finally stumbled and fallen through an errant hatchway, leading from the tunnel where he'd spent an unknown stretch of time, he lay motionless against the cold smoothness of some unfinished stretch of floor, his hands and knees aching from the long, endless trek. For a long time, he didn't dare to open his eyes, certain that when he did, the worm would be there waiting for him, coiled above him, its gasping sucker poised, ready to strike. After a moment, he became aware of bright lights shining through his eyelids and the acerbic stench of unfamiliar chemicals. Ultimately, curiosity got the best of him. He opened his eyes.
What?
The spotless, brightly lit space that surrounded him was like no other area of the prison that he'd seen before. It was part warehouse, part laboratory. Long tables held scientific equipment whose names Smite didn't know. Glass crucibles, slender tubes, and exotic-looking flasks, strangely elegant in shape and size, lined up alongside a miniature cityscape of mixing and spinning machines, instruments for heating and cooling. Along the far wall, stacks of shipping crates, all different sizes, stood in neat rows with various destinations and manifests stenciled on their sides. Not sure where he was going or why, Smite paced among the boxes and circled back to the lab equipment. None of it made any sense, nor did he expect it to. He'd long ago come to terms with his own limitations when it came to matters of science and intellect. But beyond it, on the far side of the lab, he saw something more familiar. The entire second half of the room was a different kind of workstation, equipped with state-of-the-art grinding and boring tools, fabricating machines, metal shears, drills, and precision calibration devices. Smite stared at them. He'd had an uncle who'd worked in the yards at Blastech, and he knew these things. They were weapon-making tools. The realization of what he'd stumbled across dawned in his mind like the warmth of a new sun rising, and for a moment he couldn't quite believe the magnitude of what was happening. It's here. This is it. I actually found it. He stepped back, taking in the entire space around him, the lab, the packaged crates, in light of this new revelation. Radik's operation. It's here. When Jabba had dispatched him to help infiltrate Iram Radik's operation inside Coghive 7, Smite had gone in with a certain degree of incredulity. Like everyone, he'd heard the stories of the enigmatic arms dealer operating under any number of aliases, and like most thinking people, he'd already decided there was a good deal of folklore mixed in with the truth. Why would any self-respecting gunrunner, especially one as successful as Radik, ever choose to hide out inside a prison? Particularly one in which he'd have to fight other inmates as a condition of his stay. Yet Smite had taken the job. Of course he had. As an opportunity to work his way up in the Dasilajic clan, the assignment had been impossible to turn down. Falsified ID and background papers in hand, he had arrived on site to confer with the other foot soldiers that Jabba already had working undercover as guards, gathering information from the inmates and reporting back whatever he found. The stim had helped to take the edge off, and the matches had made it interesting. But he'd never really expected this. The crates. He needed to check them. Smite crossed hurriedly to the nearest steel box, popped open the steel fasteners, and leaned forward to peer inside, sucking in a breath of whistled appreciation at what he found there. Like most of Jabba's hired hands, he prided himself in knowing about weapons. Consequently, although he might not have actually fired a J8Q-128 Finbat missile before, he recognized it immediately from its listing in Gundark's gear catalog. The Finbat was a portable, shoulder-fired concussion warhead, precision-tooled to penetrate the armor plating of military-grade vehicles. Reaching down, Smite lifted the launch tube from its packaging, hoisting it up to his shoulder, feeling the heft and power of the thing as he lowered his head toward the sight. His finger gripped the trigger. The weapon's silent promise of death spoke directly to the remnants of panic and fear still rattling around inside him from his encounter with the worm. One blast from the Finbat would annihilate anything in a 500-meter radius, including the worm. For one completely irrational moment, Smite almost considered bringing it back into the tunnel to go after the creature himself. Although, of course, such an idea was madness. Detonating a concussion missile inside a space station was suicide. But he would have loved to splatter that thing's guts all over the ventilation shaft. He set the Finbat aside and went on to the next grate, exploring its contents, already wondering how he was going to tell Jabba about what he'd found, and how he could use it to maximize his position here. Just moments earlier, he'd assumed he was a dead man. If, by some miracle, he managed to get out of here alive, Jabba would track him down and treat him like any other loose end, chopping him off. But now, He imagined the conversation, how he would tell his boss he'd discovered the very heart of what he'd been sent to find. How best to execute such a plan? While thinking it over, Smite did a quick inventory of the crates. Among many other things, he found a proton missile launcher, a pulse cannon, an entire box of Mandalorian assault rifles, flechette launchers, and something that he was pretty sure was an LS-150 heavy-accelerated charged particle repeater gun. There were several packages of explosives, including a crate of breaching grenades, anti-starfighter cluster bombs, and a carefully packaged selection of freshly manufactured thermal detonators. Upon further reflection, Smite realized that none of the weapons were technically up to factory spec. Radik had assembled them here, making subtle improvements in their precision and firing capability. He reached the last crate and stopped. Unlike the others, this one was locked. Although it was smaller than the others, it was also considerably heavier. There was no type of writing or information on it whatsoever. Even the most cursory inspection revealed that its shell was constructed of something far more formidable than Durasteel. Smite placed his hands against it. The case was warm. No, check that. The case was hot. It also seemed to be humming. Right away, even before he detected the vibrations inside it, Smite knew whatever was in the last crate was different. Far more valuable and potentially dangerous than anything else down here. Something special. Radik would never leave it here alone for very long. And he sensed that a man of Radik's intellect and experience wouldn't want to hold on to it any longer than he absolutely had to. Which meant he would be back soon. Good, a voice inside him whispered. And the idea rose into his mind unbidden. That was how Augustine Smite, once just another lackey among thousands in Jabba's army, first realized that he was destined for greatness. By the ease with which he adapted to his situation and turned it to his advantage. There wasn't much time. He went back around to the guns and artillery that he'd sorted through, hand-picking the weapons that felt most comfortable in his grasp. In the end, he settled for a DT-12 heavy blaster pistol, like one that he'd first used when he'd learned to shoot, and, because he always wanted to try them, a pair of flechette gauntlets. And so it was that he found himself strapping the holster to his belt and the gauntlets to his wrists, positioning himself against the last crate in the room, and engaging in the one activity that he'd never expected to do while he was here. Smiling.
I don't think those belong to you.
Startled, Smite stared at the figure standing in front of him.
What?
He swallowed and found his voice.
What are you doing here?
He jerked the DT-12 upward, but it was already too late. A shattering blow struck him in the side of the head, just above his right ear, and he knew no more.
Red Saber Dreams. Maul lay dreaming. It wasn't common for him, and when he did dream, he was rarely aware of it at the time.
His equivalent of REM sleep was not the sort that invited the typical neurological sorcery between conscious and unconscious thought. His warrior's brain had no use for it. So the fact that he was dreaming now, heavily sedated and stretched out in medbay with tubes and wires running through his body as he recovered from his last fight, would have come as a surprise. The simplicity of the dream only underscored its verisimilitude, and for a short time he believed it was actually happening. He was in another bout. Standing in front of the hatchway in his cell, waiting for his opponent to show himself, he looked down and saw something sitting on the floor in front of him. An unremarkable black steel box, no bigger than a mouse droid. Yet one glance told him but it held what he'd come here to find. The goal behind all his time spent slogging through the slime and filth of Coghive 7. He reached down for the box to open it, and a noise came from the other side of the wall. A grunt, the sound of something alive, preparing itself to come forth and do battle to the death. With that same irrefutable dream logic, Maul understood that this particular foe would be the most indomitable yet. Far worse than the thing he'd fought upon first arriving. Worse than the Wampa or the Aqualish or the Weequay with his clawbird. This would be the one that defeated him. The hatch slid open, and his enemy stepped out. Maul stared at him. And in the end, that part of the dream was not such a surprise after all. "Open it," the other Maul said, staring past him, down at the black box.
"It's yours. What are you waiting for?"
Maul stared back at himself, an identical reflection standing 5 meters away. Somehow, at least in the dream, the fact that he'd come here to fight himself made perfect sense. As if this moment, and not the arrangement with Iram Radik, had been the inevitable goal he'd been seeking the entire time he'd been here. And all at once, Maul knew what was in the box.
"No," he said. "My master forbids it." "Your master,"
this other Maul snarled. The answer only seemed to enrage the doppelganger.
"Don't be a fool. It belongs to you. You'll need it if you're going to defeat me. Otherwise, you're as good as dead. Take it."
"I can't. It will undermine the mission that I'm sworn to uphold."
Maul's voice constricted.
"I need to show restraint. I need to..."
"You're lost without it."
Dream or no dream, Maul felt anger boiling up in his chest, taking hold of his lungs and the nerves in his spine. His jaw clenched.
"Perhaps," he told his other self, "before you make such statements, you better try me first. Really?"
The doppelganger laughed.
"It's too late for that. You've already been weighed and measured and found wanting."
He nodded back down at the floor.
"See for yourself."
With a sudden sense of foreboding, Maul looked back at the box. It was open. It was empty. Because the item that it contained was already in his hand.
His saber staff.
Staring at it, Maul felt a crushing wave of shame come thundering over him. The realization that, in opening the box and taking up the weapon of the Sith, he'd failed his master. He had done the one thing he'd sworn not to do. And as such, the other Maul lunged for him. On reflex, without a moment's hesitation, Maul flicked the activation stud on the saber. It sprang to life in his grasp, its two red blades shooting out on either side. And in spite of everything, Maul felt a surge of power explode through his being, swallowing him up and enveloping his very soul. The certainty was upon him. The realization of his own true strength. This was what he was made for. He swung the saber staff around in a graceful whirring arc, and in a single sweeping motion, he bisected the other Maul cleanly at the waist. The upper and lower halves coming apart bloodlessly, landing in pieces on the floor of the cell. Looking down at his own face, Maul saw his own dying face smiling back up at himself.
"Good,"
his voice said, and in an instant he realized his error. He was the one on the floor, the fallen one. Looking up at himself, the other. The victor. But it wasn't his own face staring down at him anymore. It was a moon, one he didn't immediately recognize, though an uncanny familiarity encompassed his presence. The nagging sense that he should have known him, had perhaps encountered him elsewhere, in a dream within a dream. An unfamiliar name came over him like a death rattle.
Plagueis.
Darkness closed in, and when he awoke in the medbay, bathed in sweat, his fingers were gripping the cot, curled around the emptiness of the cylindrical shape that was not there.
Forty-six. Hangar.
Sliffer, huh? How long you been with the IBC? Vesta Sliffer glanced at the prison guard standing in front of him, stationed just outside Coghive 7's main hangar bay. He didn't particularly want to get into a lengthy conversation with the man, whose ID badge read Dawson, but at the moment he seemed to have little choice. The guard was bored, starved for conversation. He was balding, with a wispy gray mustache that stood in marked contrast to overgrown eyebrows, whose wiry, rebellious hairs seemed to enjoy a prehensile life all their own. I've been with the banking clan for a substantial period of time,
Sliffer said, choosing for the moment to indulge the guard.
Since the bank has held the loan on your operation here, hence my inspection of the entire facility. And then, nodding at the hatchway that led to the loading bay, now, if you don't mind. Hang on, Dawson said, swiping his badge and tapping in an access code.
The hatch slid open.
You want to watch your step in there. Landing crew's prepping for a bunch of new meat showing up in the next hour or so. So you're probably going to have to make it fast. Not a problem. Just give me a holler when you're ready to come out, Dawson said.
And as Sliffer stepped past him, he took hold of the moon's shoulder.
Oh, and hey.
Sliffer stopped, a bit taken aback.
Yes? You catch that last fight?
A broad grin spread over the guard's face.
Jagannath taking on that Weequay and his clawbird? I missed it, sadly. Sadly is right,
Dawson said.
Best match I've seen in a while. Won 300 credits on that redskin rimmer.
He beamed.
I tell you, this might not be the safest job in the world, but you get some nice perks along the way.
A thought occurred to Sliffer.
You're a gambling man yourself, are you, Mr. Dawson?
Me?
The guard sniggered.
You kidding? Does a Sarlacc live in a pit? Perhaps a sporting man such as yourself could use a little extra money from time to time. I could make it worth your while.
Dawson regarded him suspiciously.
What are we talking about here? Nothing that would get you into any trouble, of course. Simply keeping certain information to yourself and performing an errand for me later, if you have time.
What kind of errand?
I'll let you know when the time is right,
Sliffer said, waving the question away.
How often do you receive supplies here?
Weekly?
Usually a year. They offload them with the new inmates. And the binary load lifter droids that do the work, they're all networked with the prison's main data center?
Well, yeah.
Dawson pushed one hand up beneath his cap to scratch his head.
I mean, we got a couple of refurbished CLL-8s that the docking crew needs to access directly. But everything else gets run by remote from upstairs.
He squinted at Sliffer.
Why? Just trying to get a better grasp on how things run day to day,
Sliffer said and stepped through the hatch.
Thank you, officer. You've been very helpful. I'll be in touch.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
The cargo bay yawned out before him, a cavern made of steel. Moving through it, Slipher sidestepped the chief gantry officer and various members of the ground crew, scurrying around to prepare for the incoming arrival, his breath emanating visibly from his mouth in a foggy cloud. The air in here had become significantly colder, with a pervasive chill that seemed to rise up from the steel floors. Buttoning his tunic around his neck, Slipher kept moving. Workers on either side glanced up in his direction, but none of them questioned his presence. He supposed that word had already spread among them that an IBC consultant was making an on-site audit, and such interference was nearly always met with a combination of indifference and anxiety. It took him almost 5 minutes to walk across the bay. The big binary load lifters that Dawson had mentioned stood idly on the far side. Two of them lined up against the far wall, 3 meters high, awaiting instructions. Neither of them looked like newer models, although Slipher himself had only limited experience with such units. He stopped in front of the less battered-looking droid, gazing up at its single photoreceptor. "Are you equipped with a standard analytic drive?" The load lifter made a grunting noise in assent. "I'm expecting a special package with today's shipment," Slipher said. "It will be addressed to me directly. Vesto Slipher. Its contents are highly confidential and shall not be subject to any of the routine screening and security processes. I will require immediate notification when it arrives. Do you understand?" "You will keep this information to yourself and not report it to your dock supervisor," Vesto said. "This command is authorized by IBC Yellow Card Security Variant 377055. Is that understood?" The droid straightened up immediately. Something clicked inside its circuitry, and its photoreceptor brightened noticeably. The automated voice from the thing's articulator drive sounded rusty but coherent.
"Affirmative."
"Good," Slipher said. "I'll expect to hear from you soon."
"47. Airborne." Maul awoke to a prevailing sense of doom. Rising on the slow, dark tide of consciousness, he felt remembrance of what he'd done settling over him like another form of gravity, heavier and more oppressive than the prison itself. For a moment he just lay there, staring up at the medbay ceiling, its austere rectangles outlined by the recessed lighting of sleeping diagnostic equipment. Why was he still alive? The meaning of the dream was clear enough. He'd failed his master, failed his mission. Ultimately, he'd been betrayed, not by some foreign enemy, but by his own survival instincts. But what else could he have done? Dying here would have accomplished nothing. Still, he could not shake the feeling that this had been a test, and he had failed. There was nothing left for him now. Thoughts began to organize themselves in his brain. He would need to get back to the transmitter in the morgue and contact his master to explain his position, if Sidious would even speak to him. In all likelihood, the chain reaction of plausible deniability had already been initiated. His master could very well have decided to leave him here to rot. Or, all at once, Maul heard a noise above his head. A brisk whirring sound that he guessed was the surgical droid. The thing would be here to change out his IV tubing, to check the readings of the instruments wired to his skull and chest. Looking over, he saw something completely different. A clawbird perched on the end of the table, staring at him. Maul scowled at it.
"I killed you, bird. Ripped you to pieces. Left you broken on the cell floor next to your master. What are you still doing here?
While he was looking at the thing, trying to work out the details of its miraculous resurrection, a second bird swept down and landed next to it. And then a third. Sitting up, Maul looked around. The room was filled with birds. With a faint croak, the first bird hopped from the end of the table to Maul's leg, and then up to his shoulder, where it settled itself. He turned his head to gaze at it, at the knotted quipus wound around its legs.
Of course.
Their former master would have needed more than one bird to pick up the different weapons parts and drop off the payment, and now that Maul had killed him, he was their new master. Yanking the monitor wires and tubing away from his body, Maul tossed it all to the floor and swung his legs around. Standing up, he discovered new strength that he hadn't known was there. All around him, clawbirds seemed to sense this renewed purpose. They'd already begun to flap their wings, rising into the air, preparing to take flight. Maul nodded.
Let's go.
Following the birds was easier this time. They flew just ahead of him, in a black and rustling cloud, leading him through the main concourse, where the other inmates drew back in obeisance, stepping away, some of them even lowering their heads, as if recognizing some newly coronated ruler. Maul pursued them downward through a labyrinth of passageways. When the path became narrow, the flock flattened itself out, and when it opened again, they spread again to fill the available space. They went on like that for what felt like a very long time, deeper down than he'd imagined the prison ever went, although it was difficult to gauge distances and depths in a world that was constantly changing. A stillness came over the world, a sense that he was venturing where few had gone. At last, Maul stood before a closed door. The hatchway opened.
"Jagannath," a voice said from inside. "Welcome to the Inner Circle."